It's Friday and time to enjoy a little conversation to send you off to a holiday weekend. I'm Rhonda McBride. Coming up on Juno Afternoon, the Thlinkit called them Sick Noon, the bear that disappears. The bear with silver gray fur that blends in with glaciers. Dr. Martin Luther King, how two groups plan to honor his legacy by asking for your help. How a Juno musician celebrates his birthday, it's become a tradition that George Kuhar shares with the whole community. Watch remains in effect for most of Southeast Alaska due to excessive rain on top of an already heavy snowpack. In Juneau, rain is in the forecast through Saturday, with daytime and nighttime temperatures hovering in the mid-30s. Winds out of the southeast around 10 miles per hour. Tonight and tomorrow morning, a mix of rain and snow in Mendenhall Valley, but little or no accumulation. A chance of rain in the afternoon, and then on Saturday night, a mix of snow and rain with the snow level at 1,400 feet. On Sunday, rain is likely in the morning and then snow later on, with the snow level at 800 feet. Winds out of the east around 10 miles per hour. On Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow showers and patchy freezing fog. It will turn colder with lows in the mid-20s. On Martin Luther King Day, expect partly cloudy skies with highs in the upper 20s, a pattern expected to continue through Tuesday night, and then a chance of snow showers returns to the forecast. The sun will rise at 8:30 on Saturday morning, set at 3:45 for a total of 7 hours and 15 minutes of daylight.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Thlinkit have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on what were once tide lands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and the future.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk are ye tin. Jin Katka K Jin Tauk and a Haya on a Kuk Gunish Cheese.
For being here with us today. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Glacier bears do not exist anywhere else but in Southeast Alaska and British Columbia. Mysterious black bears known for their silvery gray, bluish fur, rarely seen and rarely photographed. But Tanya Lewis, a wildlife biologist with Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve, counts herself lucky to see these bears. She has been involved in a 10-year study in collaboration with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that includes DNA research, the subject of tonight's fireside lecture, which you can watch online. I spoke with Tanya Lewis earlier this week about her research, in which she says there is still much to learn. For starters, Tanya, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into researching this special subset of bears, glacier bears?
Sure. Yeah, I moved to Gustavus, which is right outside Glacier Bay National Park in 94. You know, started kayaking around a lot and became really interested in bears and learned all I could about bears, along with other wildlife. Wolves, mountain goats have always been very fascinating. I started working as a biological technician for the park in 99 on a variety of projects and just kind of worked my way up, I guess. They hired me in 2001 to lead a crew for the first comprehensive look at bear ecology and bear-human interactions between bears and campers in the park. So I did that for a few years, and then they hired me in 2006 to write the park's first bear management plan. And through that process, we identified some research needs for the park, one of which was understanding this mysterious glacier bear, which seems to be focused in its range in the park. So that kind of got the ball rolling on this project, along with quite a few other bear related projects.
What was it like the first time you saw a glacier bear? Do you remember that?
Well, I saw one in one of my first summers working for the park, the humpback whale monitoring program. So we were looking for whales in Berg Bay, which is on the west side of the park. And we saw this family group of black bears, and my coworker, Janet Nielsen, said, "That's a glacier bear." And at that point, I probably didn't know what a glacier bear was. I was like, "What? What?" And I can't remember if it was either one or two of the cubs were glacier, I believe. I don't think I really recognized the significance of that sighting because I didn't really see another one until a few years ago. We were boating along and watching a black bear, and all of a sudden realized the black bear had two gray rocks with it that were moving with it. And those were the cubs. At that point, I had started this research and was just fascinated watching them and how beautiful the colors of their coats were and how they blended in so well with the intertidal zone because of their gray color.
That's interesting that they would appear like rocks, that this is some kind of a genetic adaptation to help them avoid predators, apparently.
Yeah, and this is jumping the gun a little bit, but a lot of the speculation about these animals was that they evolved during ice ages and so that they camouflage with a glacier environment. And well, my assumption was that, well, that meant they camouflage with ice, but in a glacial environment, there's also a lot of rocks, and rocks tend to be gray in general. So it could be not just ice that they're camouflaged with, but also rocks, and that gave them a selective advantage for this mutation, genetic mutation, if that's what it is, to persist in a glacial environment during ice ages.
Well, we'll come back to the genetic research, but you have just mentioned that they have a range of colors that are not black. They're distinctive. Can you describe what we might see out in nature?
Yeah, the range is basically from black with silver tips, usually on their back. You know, just a silver sheen, really, on the tips of their hairs, mostly back and head. And then they range all the way to almost all white. But the most common is sort of a black bottom or darker bottom with a very gray, light gray top, back, neck. That's probably the most common. But sometimes they can even appear a little bit yellow, not quite blonde, I wouldn't say, but just gray, yellow, I guess.
Well, humans have different hair colors, blonde, brunette, mm-hmm. redheads. We're basically human beings, the same creature, despite our hair color. Do these glacier bears have specific biological differences from black bears?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't think so, but there is hair color and coat color in animals is largely based on genetics. And so there is likely a genetic basis for this color morph that we have not identified yet. They're black bears. Pretty sure they mate with black colored black bears, and they act like black bears for the most part. So same animal.
And they don't have any differences in temperament. Because, for example, with brown bears, grizzly bears, they are definitely more aggressive than, say, black bears. So you notice no difference in the temperament from black bears.
you know, I don't have enough experience, and I don't think anyone has enough experience interacting with glacier bears to really know their temperament, but they appear to act just like other black bears. And just to clear up or sort of go dive further into the brown bear versus black bear behavioral difference with brown bears is not necessarily that they're more aggressive. It's that they evolved in the tundra and there was no trees to climb. Black bears will climb trees when they're scared or threatened. Brown bears evolving in an open terrain learn to face their enemies, I guess. And when they feel threatened, they may attack. That's why they're considered more dangerous. But it's not that they're out looking to hurt us. It's just that if we surprise them in a situation where they feel threatened, maybe they have cubs, maybe they're defending their food, they may attack. And that's the majority of bear attacks, you know, in Alaska and everywhere in North America are defensive brown bears. So I just like to clarify, they're not necessarily aggressive. The reason they attack is because they think we're going to hurt them. More dangerous, not necessarily more aggressive.
So environment is affecting the temperament of the bear. But I guess for people who wonder about the differences between black bears, brown bears, polar bears, I mean, what is the physical difference and why they're classified differently?
Well, they did evolve differently in different places. Brown and black bears diverged millions of years ago. You know, black bears evolved on North America and brown bears in Asia and then came over on the Bering Land Bridge. So they've had millions of years of development separately. But I think the main aspect that affects their behavior is how they evolved in what environments. And so it's believed that black bears evolved in a forested environment. And if you look at their range, they really seem dependent on trees for escape, as opposed to what I just mentioned with brown bears evolving on the tundra. And so basically, where it relates to human interactions, it really comes down to what a bear does when it's surprised. And black bears usually run up a tree, whereas brown bears will stand their ground, maybe display some threatening behavior, try to scare off us or, you know, the threat, and then sometimes rarely attack. Now, all of that kind of goes out the window when bears get food from people. And in that case, both black and brown bears can become a problem because they start looking to people for food. And that becomes dangerous in any bear species. And so, you know, that's one thing I'll talk about on Friday is just how important it is in the world of bear conservation to not let bears get our food. And that's a big issue in Juneau, as well as most towns in Alaska or wherever there's bears.
Always, always. I guess a silver bear or a glacier bear is going to be just as eager to raid your trash as a black bear. But maybe we should talk about the glacier bear's population. How rare are they?
Yeah, that is one of the questions, one of the first questions we had and why we started this research. And unfortunately, we don't have an answer to that. They're very rare. We don't know how many there are. We have kind of honed in on their general range. We know how many are hunted every year, but that doesn't really give an idea of how many are still left in the population. The only way to truly get at that would be to identify the genetic basis for the color and then look at a sample of the population and figure out what proportion of bears in different areas have that genetic trait that codes for the glacier hair color.
We have seen some bears in Juneau in the past, some of the glacier bears, they've made it here, but it's not that often that we see them here.
In the early 2000s, some listeners here will remember there was kind of a glut of glacier bears in Juneau. They were getting into trash. They were getting hit on Egan by cars. So likely it was a family, maybe a mom with glacier genetics came in, and there must have been a male around too. They produced a number of offspring that were commonly seen in the town. And I think we just didn't know how cool and rare that was at the time. But I know at least one was killed on Egan. One was killed, I believe, in defense of life and property. Several were translocated out of town because they were getting into trash and creating trouble. But luckily, the area biologist for Fish and Game at the time, Neil Barton, he started collecting genetic samples from these bears when they were moved or killed or any time he had a chance. And that was really the basis of our genetic sampling from the start and kind of got the ball rolling. Meanwhile, I was, as I said, writing the bear management plan for Glacier Bay and inherited this map of sightings and harvests of glacier bears throughout Southeast Alaska that Linda Wiggins, a Canadian woman, had put together, and started kind of wondering, how could we get genetic samples from Glacier Bay where there's no hunting allowed? And that led to Neil and I getting together with some others and saying, we really need to get more genetic material. I mean, that's kind of the first step, is like, what are these animals and how are they related to other populations of black bears in the region? Where are they? Where's sort of the epicenter of their range? And is there a conservation risk for these animals in the future?
It makes you wonder if they could be at risk because they're unusual and hunters might specifically target them.
Absolutely. I would say that they are definitely targeted by trophy hunters in this region. It's the only place in the world you can get a glacier bear, basically. Knowing kind of proportions of glacier genes in the populations is really important in terms of ensuring the longevity of the color, coat color.
Did the DNA research answer some questions for you?
Yeah. So basically, we found out of 10 populations of black bears in Southeast Alaska, we found 4 of which have glacier bears in them. You know, that was one of our questions. Is it just one population of bears that all the glacier bears belong to? But no, it was 4 different populations. And interestingly, those 4 populations they're not geographically adjacent. There's a big gap in between. That is pretty curious as far as how those genetics basically have spread throughout 4 populations, or perhaps they were all part of a single population, you know, before the last glacial maximum that has then spread out. But curiously, the hole in the middle, which is basically between Lynn Canal and Glacier Bay, where there are no glacier bears, is the least glaciated area of our study area. And the populations that did have glacier bears all adjoin major ice fields. And so can't say for sure, but kind of going back to that camouflage advantage, it does make us wonder if they are associated with glaciers and have, you know, a selective advantage to being in glacial environments. And if that's the case, then we may have more concern about them as glaciers start to recede in the area.
So we have a few pictures on the KTOO Juno Afternoon website, and you can see a mix of cubs in families. Like, you might see a black bear sow with 2 glacier bear cubs, or 1 glacier bear cub and another black bear cub. And so it seems like the way that they appear doesn't really have a logical pattern, or does it?
Yeah. So like you said, glacier mothers can have non-glacial black offspring, or vice versa. Black mothers can have glacial offspring as well as black offspring. So it indicates that it's a recessive trait, similar to blue eyes, blonde hair, where you would need to have basically the genes that code for that color from both your mom and your dad, or else you won't be that color, basically. So we think that's true. As I said, we have not figured out the genetic basis. It seems to be a lot more complex than some other similar situations, such as the Kermodee or spirit bear in British Columbia is a pure white bear that has the same trait where, you know, black moms have Kermodee cubs, Kermodee moms have black cubs. So similar to that, and that trait, the genetics that code for that coat color was found maybe 15, 20 years ago. And it's a lot simpler than what we're finding with the glacier bears. But we do know, or strongly suspect, it must be a recessive genetic trait or mutation. Mutation just means that, you know, because most bears don't have it, at some point, probably under isolation due to glaciers, single bear mutated and that genetic trait perhaps randomly or was selected for because it gave an advantage and it was able to pass on to future generations. So that's our working hypothesis anyway.
So what do indigenous cultures have to say about this? Has there been much research into to what they've passed on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I dug into that when I started this research, and I haven't found a lot, but I talked to a Tlingit elder in Yakutat, George Ramos, and he had the most information that I've found. I haven't seen anything really written, but he described glacier bears as being elusive, and they actually called the bear that disappears. I think in terms of camouflage, just blending into the glaciated environment and disappearing. In the old days, they didn't actually hunt these bears because they recognized them as being special and rare, and that the first hunters of glacier bears were actually European trophy hunters that came in the early 1900s or late 1800s. So that's the only information I've really been able to find besides a few references to glacier bears in various cultural ethnographies, but yeah, not a lot of information.
Okay. And I understand that in your lecture, you will also have a lot more pictures of the glacier bears. And I imagine that those are pretty special to see.
Yeah, that's probably the most fun part of putting this talk together is just collecting like the best glacier bear pictures that I can find. But there's really not that many pictures out there. You know, I have about 10 or 15 that show the wide range that we were talking about in terms of coat color, from just barely silver tipped to almost all white. So that's a real fun part of this presentation, I think.
Lewis, a wildlife biologist with Glacier Bay National Park Service. She was scheduled to give her presentation at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center tonight at 7, but that has been moved online due to the recent spike in COVID cases. So go to the Mendenhall Visitor Center Facebook page and you can watch her lecture live at 7. Next, Martin Luther King's legacy remembered not just in words, but also in deeds. How you can take part. For joining us for Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. With Martin Luther King Day coming up on Monday, many of you are probably looking forward to a three-day weekend. But for AmeriCorps members across the United States, it is also a day to embrace Dr. King's call to service, to do something, to make his dream a reality. I recently spoke with Sherry Paul, director of AmeriCorps in Juneau. Also in our conversation, Monica Wayford, who serves in the AmeriCorps Seniors Program, and Bridget Monks, an AmeriCorps member who works as a suicide prevention coordinator. Sherry, why don't we begin with you to explain the connection between AmeriCorps and MLK Day?
Sure. So the connection between MLK Day and AmeriCorps, the main connection is service, because Dr. King's legacy of service and leadership and equality was for all Americans throughout the country. His belief was to support each community, and he called it beloved community, which I think is phenomenal, and to really enhance and raise awareness that all people of all colors can come together and enhance their community to make it a wonderful place to live. And in 1994, Congress designated Martin Luther King as a federal holiday and as a national day of service to take part in fulfilling Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. Congress charged AmeriCorps to provide a full day of service. And AmeriCorps is throughout the country. So there's thousands of AmeriCorps members that are providing a special day of their service year to MLK Day and to raising awareness of MLK, his legacy, and the legacy of giving back to community.
So we have Monica and Bridget with us, who are helping to organize this year's MLK Day of Service with the Black Awareness Association of Juneau. Monica, could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? Because you are one of those AmeriCorps members that had a career in serving others. And so in your retirement, you've signed up to continue this work. What made you do that?
I didn't think I was finished. I've had a life that I have enjoyed of social work, and I didn't believe that I was finished. I am retired, but I still have a lot to give, and I still have a lot to learn. And I am doing that with AmeriCorps at the Shea Hot Hit. I'm still getting used to how to say it. And I am learning so much and gaining so much from this experience.
So you are working in a shelter for young people then?
That's correct. Also, I'm doing some work at the Zach Gordon Youth Services.
So you came all the way from Michigan to offer your services. What made you come all the way up here?
A wish, a dream always to live in Alaska. Since I've been a child, it's always fascinated me. It didn't disappoint from my dream of coming here, my goal of living here since I was a kid. I always believed that this was a magical place. The people are as kind and the land is as beautiful as I had imagined.
So how does it feel a second time around to be working with people, this time not necessarily in a paid job, but as part of service? Is it different in any way?
It's not. Nonprofits, the pay is not the incentive ever, because with a nonprofit, you're working with a small amount anyway. So the service to people, the community, the sense of community, something that is like my ticket to heaven.
That is so wonderful to hear. So many people think of heaven as doing something for themselves and not necessarily for others. And that's not a bad thing, but it's interesting that that's your path. So Bridget Monks, you are one of the younger AmeriCorps volunteers, a recent college graduate. So what are you doing for AmeriCorps in Juneau?
So I'm working with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Juneau Branch, and Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition. My job is the training and outreach coordinator. Essentially, what I'm doing is I'm putting out resources and different information, just kind of getting people connected to the different things that they need in terms of their mental health and well-being.
So tell us a little bit about your background, Bridget.
So I'm from Connecticut. After I graduated university, I wanted to continue my goal of service, which was kind of fueled by my year doing a different AmeriCorps program, the National Civilian Conservation Corps. So I came up to Alaska. I was looking for different AmeriCorps positions, and I've always had a drawing towards behavioral health and mental conditions. And I saw that there was an opening here, and I decided to apply and got in and just said, send it. And I came.
Well, welcome. And we're very lucky to have the both of you here. Monica, I want to go back to you. What does the MLK Day of Service mean to you since you've been in the social work profession for a long time?
I, too, have served in AmeriCorps before. It means to me that we are truly giving back to our community and we're gathering people to do the same.
Monica, it almost sounds like you are hooked on public service. What is it that makes you want to keep giving back?
I have a lot of empathy and I can feel and experience what people are experiencing right now. We're in hard times and we haven't seen times like this in a while. I'm going to be 64 years old, and this has been part of the toughest times that I know of in my life. And I have a desire to not just sit by and watch. I want to give and help.
So can a day of service be contagious in your experience?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that people who are experiencing hardship right now are seeing that they could be in the same shoes as their neighbor, and they want people to reach out to them now. As before, we've been kind of segregated in our thinking and our experience. Now we're all together in this big boat together, and I believe that it's contagious because we know that we could be in the same boat and we want to help because it may be a neighbor, it may be a relative, or it may be ourselves. So we want to reach out and do what we can.
How about you, Bridget? What does the day of service mean to you?
I think it's really a beautiful thing because what MLK was trying to really put out there was who better to make the community better than all of us. Like each and every single individual person has a place, has a role to fit in serving their community. And so to be a leader, to be a header in that with my fellow AmeriCorps members is just fantastic, to be able to guide people and be able to give people the resources that need them and to also corral other people to be the ones to participate, because there's nothing that feels better in the world than knowing that you made someone else's day better. I know that's how I feel, and I know that's how a lot of other people do feel as well.
Do you remember specifically when the Martin Luther King Day of Service resonated with you, when you said, yes, this is something I want to be a part of?
The fact that we're working with the Black Awareness Association just really pulls everything together for me and makes it that much more fulfilling knowing that we're helping and being community members with people of all different colors, creeds, backgrounds. So I think it's really great that we're all coming together. And that's what resonates a lot with me.
So Monica, same question for you is, the first time that you heard about the MLK Day of Service, when was that and when did it sort of catch fire with you?
I was serving in Detroit, Michigan, and we were working on community gardens and cleaning up the area. And it felt good when we had a finished product of fresh vegetables where there had been food deserts. And kids, they had the joy of eating fresh vegetables and also cleaning the community and the way it presented and looked when people walked through and they were like, wow, you know, this area looks nothing like it did before. I think it resonated with me because being a person of color myself, there was a sense of belonging to the greater community, not just my community. And I believe that's what Dr. King wanted from us.
So do you think that MLK Day and participating in it is an important part of an educational process and maybe understanding what some of our struggling neighbors are going through?
Absolutely. I believe that. Absolutely.
Obviously, MLK Day helps the people that you're trying to help, it does some good. But what have you seen happen with the people that you pull into MLK Day to become a part of it?
It's like the changes that Dr. King made during his lifetime. He made some extraordinary changes on views of different communities. He made extraordinary changes with civil rights. And I believe that people gain that knowledge from participating, and they feel that sense that he shared with us of belonging to the greater community.
You know, they say that the act of giving is more important for the giver than the recipient sometimes.
Being able to donate, yeah, is great. But then also donating a coat and seeing someone later wearing that, you're going to see a world of difference in that the person who gave and also the person who received that coat. Going to be warm. A lot of the time when you donate food, you don't really see what it is, but that's like nourishing somebody. There's a lot of different ways you can donate and help, and not always is it going to be as visible as giving somebody a coat and seeing them wear it, but it's going to make a huge difference in just the way that that person relates to the world and the way that they're going to maybe you're the step that someone needs that is going to project them to getting a job and being able to take care of themselves, or just in general, take care of their family, get a safe place for their kids.
Sherry, this year you are looking at trying to get lots of people involved in collecting things that Glory Hall and Aware need. Tell us a little bit about how this is very targeted giving in some ways. It's not random giving.
Yeah, that's a great question. So part of Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy is collaboration. And we're all collaborating, whether like AmeriCorps here has been collaborating a lot with Clinkett and Haida, enhancing projects that they need to get done. Now we're collaborating with the Black Awareness Association. And that's part of who I am, I feel as well, is the director, that if you're coming to our community of Juneau, you should become involved and help make the community a better place. It's part of my Jewish heritage as well, of Tikkun Olam, making the world a better place. And in fact, Dr. Martin Luther King spoke at our synagogue in Evanston, Illinois, back in the 60s, because we have similar philosophies of making our world a better place. And so whether a person, an individual, is giving a box of ramen noodles or giving a jacket, one of the requests from Aware is work clothes, new work clothes. So if we are able to donate, the community is able to donate a nice dress shirt, how is that person who's going to put that dress shirt on going to feel when they have a new shirt? It will hopefully uplift them, and hopefully their interview will make them shine by them personally feeling better and presenting themselves in a nicer light. So whether it's a canned good or it's a new pair of socks to feel warm or a warm jacket, people will just feel good about giving that, as Bridget said, and then receiving it on the other end.
So Glory Hall and Aware have asked for specific things.
Correct. And it is a fairly lengthy list. So we will post those lists on the K2 website, on United Way of Southeast website, on the Black Awareness Association website. But if you think of what you would need if you lived at the Glory Hall or you lived at the Aware Shelter temporarily, what are those things? Which are socks, gloves, hand warmers, work clothes, toiletries, toothpaste, travel size toothpaste, granola bars to carry with you. These are items that are on the list. So I wouldn't worry so much if you don't collect the right thing, because everything is valuable, but we will have the list posted.
All righty. So can you recap how we can participate in this?
Sure. So I'd love the community to participate by collecting goods from either what you have laying around in your home or picking up a few things at the stores in Juneau. So you're supporting stores in Juneau and bringing them over to St. Paul's Church on Monday from 11 to 3. And St. Paul's Catholic Church is on Atlin Drive, right off of Back Loop Road. Or you could drop them off. You could go to IGA or Super Bear, and there will be boxes there. And while you're shopping, pick up a case of ramen noodles or granola bars and stick them on your way out in the box.
Tell us a little bit about the work that Monica and Bridget do, and you know, what kind of a network are they a part of?
Well, AmeriCorps State National, which is what we are, we're called service members. We provide a service, an unmet need in the Juneau community. We have 9 members in Juneau serving either in the elementary schools, providing support for struggling readers. We have some members at Southeast Regional Resource Center that are helping adults 18 and over with their GEDs. We have Monica and Bridget at their sites. And so the difference between a service member and a volunteer is our members get a really small stipend to live on. They only receive $1,450 a month to pay for rent and food and entertainment. So they are in that low income bracket too. And that was the philosophy of AmeriCorps, is to really be with the community and help the community where the most need is. They also receive an education award at the end of their term, which is 11 months, about 1,700 hours of service. It's a big commitment, a huge reward, a huge feeling of giving back, but not a lot of pay.
To get this kind of expertise from Monica and Bridget, their backgrounds, seems like it's a real gift to the community.
It is a gift to community, and it's a gift to the children at the schools who are falling behind because of COVID, to have the one-on-one support that they're receiving from 3 of our AmeriCorps members right now. The one thing, though, that we always have to mention is AmeriCorps members cannot replace an employee. So they're going into these nonprofits or the school district filling a need that has not been met and that cannot be met.
So before we go, Monica and Bridget, can you give us a few words of encouragement to participate in this year's MLK Day?
For leaving the holiday season, a suggestion I would have would be, don't take those Christmas gifts back. Don't make them.
Good idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you, Sherry Paul, Monica Wayford, and Bridget Monk, for joining us from AmeriCorps, and hope that your drive goes really well and astounds everybody.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. We appreciate it.
Want to be important? Wonderful. If you want to be recognized? Wonderful. If you want to be great? Wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great.
Everyone.
Because everybody can serve.
Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, 2 months away from his assassination, from his sermon called The Drum Major Instinct. Coming up, it's George Kuhar's birthday, and everyone is invited to celebrate this Juneau musician's big day. This is Juno Afternoon, and you're listening to George Kuhar and his band Playboy Spaceman. Glad to have you here with us on this Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride. Birthdays are many things to many people. And for one Juno musician, they're about sharing what you love. And for George Kuhar, that's his music. Decade, George Kuhar has invited audiences to a free birthday concert. This Sunday will be his 11th, and I recently talked with him about how this tradition got started. Every year you do a birthday show, you perform for people. What's the reason for doing that specific to your birthday? Why not just any day of the year?
It's affirming. Being an artist, it's a good, healthy reminder of like who I am and what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. It's been really nice to see the same faces show up every year. There's some people who've come every single year, and that's really meaningful to me. You know, people always thank me for doing it because it's a free show, but really it's good for me because it really helps affirm like who I am and what I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
Can you talk about that a little bit, about how music is a part of who you are?
I guess, you know, I've always loved music. You know, I guess any musician who plays music over the course of their lifetime, they just can't imagine life without it. It's always been something that's been a part of me. And when you're a musician, it's something that's always been there. You know, this deep love and appreciation for music. It gives you so much. And you in turn have this, or at least I do, feel compelled to give whatever I can to music itself. And usually that just takes form of trying to make new and interesting music and just make the best music that I possibly can. You know, I'm just one little person out of, you know, 8 billion or whatever, but hoping that my little contribution can help music as a whole. And music, as we all know, is good for humanity. That's why it's been around for so long.
Tell us a little bit about the group that you have.
Playboy Spaceman, yeah. So, you know, that started as a recording project in 2010. I had released an instrumental album just exclusively to KXLL. They're the only ones who had it. It's not out there online or anything. And then eventually my wife and I, Bridget, we started playing shows together as a duo under the name Playboy Spaceman. And then eventually we recruited other members of the community to join the band. We played as a five-piece ensemble for several years. And then, of course, because of COVID, we haven't been playing live. So now it's gone back to its roots of being a recording project.
You've got some new work that you're going to be debuting on your birthday show. What piece would you like us to hear right now?
So this new piece is called Christopher, and it's going to be available as a free download to anybody on my mailing list. So if you go to playboyspaceman.com, you can go there, join the mailing list, download it. Yeah, it's called Christopher.
So tell us a little bit about it.
So it's a song. It's about a kid who's in a kind of in a stressful situation in his family life, and he's trying to come to terms with that. And you hear different voices, different characters throughout the song to kind of get a full picture of what he's hearing around him.
All right, let's give Christopher a listen.
Now let's play some music. We'll be right back.
You are listening to a new piece from George Kuhar, Christopher. And if you want to hear more, go to his website, playboyspaceman.com, and you can download it for free. So you've got quite a birthday tradition going, and it's not stopping because of COVID. You're going to move your birthday program online. So tell us how you do your birthday program online.
Well, you know, this is kind of a new thing for me. I've been doing the show live. 8 of the years it had been at the Rookery, that's down there on Seward. But last year, because of COVID, I had to move it online. So I'm going to do a little differently this year. It's still going to be online. But last year I performed live. I did a live stream performance for, you know, everybody who showed up and tuned in. This year, I'm going to pre-record the performance and live host it. And the reason I'm doing that is because I wanted to be able to participate in the live chat. So I just wanted to try that out and see what that was going to be like. You know, last year I just sat down in the room and I played and that was it. So this year I'd actually kind of like to feel a little more connection with the audience. So that's why I'm going to do it this way.
A lot of performers have had their concerts moved online, web streaming, or on Facebook Live just because of COVID. You know, we've just had to do workarounds. But for you, why is it important, too, that you just can't go out and give live concerts?
I am a kidney transplant recipient. My wife donated a kidney to me in 2008. And of course, that makes me immune compromised, too. That's the package deal with having a solid organ transplant. So, you know, I'm at a higher risk than the general population. I find myself playing a little extra safe. I went through a big medical ordeal last year. It's just something that happened as a complication to some of my medications. So I'm not inviting any danger into my life. I got plenty coming my way already.
So do you think that this kidney condition is part of what makes your birthday concert so special to you personally? Because you have personally come to know that every birthday is a gift?
It must. I mean, I can't separate myself from my kidney condition. I'm tethered to it. So it's definitely a part of who I am as a musician and what I'm trying to say and achieve as an artist. You know, this show it's an affirmation for me. It helps give me strength and courage to keep doing it and keep playing music and keep writing music.
And support from people, too. Just being able to share the music with someone is important, too, I guess, in fueling the need to produce more.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's where that affirmation comes from is, you know, the people who show up every year. You know, I had one friend who told me that this is one of the events that some people in town anchor their lives around. How do I take that in? When somebody says something like that to me, it's like, oh, I gotta do this again. I can't, you know, not. I can't skip it just because it's COVID or whatever. You know, I gotta find a way to keep this going. It's after the New Year's, before session begins, there's George Kuhar's birthday show.
So what is the spirit behind George Kuhar's birthday show, beyond the fact that we're celebrating your birthday? But it seems like you should be getting gifts, but you're trying to give something back on your birthday show.
Yeah, you know, the spirit, a lot of people feel a bring down in January. Oh, the holidays are over, you know, but January for me has always been a great month. It's my birth month. And I really get into that new year kind of energy, that kind of spirit. Like, let's start again. Let's start again. Let's keep it going. That to me is the spirit of the show.
Okay, so for people who want to listen to your birthday show, watch it, what do we do?
You go to playboyspaceman.com and there'll be a link on the homepage there for you to tune into the live stream. That's all you got to do.
That's all we got to do. And yep. What time?
The stream starts at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 16th.
Okay, 6 o'clock, be there, be square. And we're going to close out with one of your new songs. Tell us about that one. It's kind of a weird title about dirty laundry.
Your dirty laundry closet. This was from a project that I put out in October called Noise Story. It's on PlayboySpaceman.com too. And Your Dirty Laundry Closet is a song I wrote like towards the beginning of the pandemic. Honestly, I don't know too much what it means. I know a little bit. All the songs that are on that project, Noise Story, were all just stream of consciousness, off the cuff kind of lyrics. I didn't want to think about them too much. Where Christopher's a different, I've really thought about those lyrics a lot. Your Dirty Laundry Closet just came to me. I sang it, recorded it, bam, it's done.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave you now listening to the Dirty Laundry Closet song. We all have those, you know. All right. Thank you so much, George Kuhar. 6 o'clock Sunday night. Website again?
PlayboySpaceman.com.
That title alone is interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that will do it for Juno Afternoon broadcast from Klingit Ani on KTOO 104.3 FM. Juno Afternoon airs live at 3, Tuesday through Friday, and repeats at 7. You can also listen online at ktoo.org. Juno Afternoon is a production of the KTOO Arts and Culture team, which includes Shelley Delaney, KXLL Chandra Boom, and the leader of our team, Cheryl Snyder. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for today. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Until next time, thanks for joining the conversation. From all of us at KTOO, Gunashchish. Have a good evening and a good weekend.